huge dinner party for Trump. He was thrilled by all the attention he was getting. I was with the top-level people, both oligarchs and generals, and top-of-the-government people, he said later on the Hugh Hewitt radio show. I can't go further than that, but I will tell you that I met the top people, and the relationship was extraordinary. Exactly what happened next is unclear. Trump later told FBI Director James Comey that he returned to New York and didn't even stay overnight. He said he arrived in the morning, did events, then showered and dressed for the pageant at the hotel, Comey wrote in a memo. Afterwards, he returned only to get his things because they departed for New York by plane that same night. But Trump's account, as reported by Comey, does not ring true. The time of landing is unspecified in flight records, according to Bloomberg, but it was early enough to afford Trump much of Friday in Moscow during the day, all of Friday night, and all day Saturday, before his flight left at 3:58 a.m. Sunday. The bottom line was that Trump claimed not to have even spent one night in Moscow, but according to records, he had one full overnight in Moscow and another night that went into the early hours. That left some time, but not much, for fun. Answers to what exactly happened during that period may or may not be found in a report put together by former MI6 agent Christopher Steele that has become famously known as the Steele dossier. Steele, who is fluent in Russian, was no naive when it came to the Kremlin. Back in the early 90s, he had worked in Moscow under diplomatic cover out of the British embassy during the turbulent ascent of the oligarchs. But he returned to London, and in November 2006, Steele was put in charge of MI6's investigation into the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko. When the official report of the Litvinenko inquiry was released, it backed up Steele's findings that the murder was an FSB hit that was probably approved by Vladimir Putin. Steele soon left MI6 for the private sector and in 2009 started a small investigative research firm called Orbis Business Intelligence. Among his clients was the FBI, which hired him to help crack Tokhtakonov's gambling and money laundering ring in Trump Tower. Steele became aware of Tokhtakonov's presence at the Miss Universe pageant and was agog at his proximity to Trump. It was as if all criminal roads led to Trump Tower, he told friends. In the spring of 2016, Orbis agreed to become a subcontractor for Fusion GPS, a research firm in Washington that had been hired by the Perkins Coie law firm, which represented both Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign and the Democratic National Committee. Steele's job was to investigate Republican candidate Donald Trump. The Steele dossier, much of which has not been corroborated, became a sensation when it was made public by BuzzFeed in 2017 for its astonishing allegations that Trump's campaign accepted a regular flow of intelligence from the Kremlin, including on his Democratic and other political rivals, that Russian operatives had been cultivating Trump for years, and that they had obtained compromat by recording videos of Trump engaging in personal obsessions and sexual perversions. If there was compromat on Trump, it seemed likely that the mafia would know, so I posed that question to a knowledgeable source who had direct experience with the Russian underworld. Does Mogilevich have compromat on Trump, I asked. Does the mafia know? Of course they do, he told me. Everyone talks about it. Seva, Mogilevich, and Michas, Mikhailov. But my source cautioned that he had not seen any compromat firsthand, only that he had heard about it. His allegations have not been corroborated. Chapter 18. The Battle is Joined. In March 2014, Russia allegedly conducted a massive internet disruption in Ukraine, just as it was seizing and annexing the Crimea. As usual, Roger Stone, Paul Manafort's sometime partner, seemed to know exactly what was going on and reveled in its venality, according to Politico, by sending out an email to a small group of friends. "Where is Paul Manafort?" Stone's email asked. Among the multiple choices he suggested were the following. "Was seen chauffeuring Yanukovych around Moscow," and "was seen loading gold bullion on an army transport plane from a remote airstrip outside Kiev and taking off seconds before a mob arrived at the site." The final option was, "is playing golf in Palm Beach." But Manafort was merely the tip of the iceberg. By this time, many of the leaders of the Republican Party were effectively on the payroll of the Kremlin, which had become as effective as Big Oil or Big Pharma at using K Street lobbyists to serve its agenda. The only difference was that they were essentially serving the interests of Vladimir Putin in the most heated geostrategic sector on the planet. Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska, who had hired former senator and Republican presidential nominee Bob Dole as a lobbyist in 2005, later tried, unsuccessfully, to woo Senator John McCain, the GOP presidential nominee, in 2008. Russian conglomerate Alpha paid nearly $2 million in lobbying fees to Barber, Griffith & Rogers, the lobbying firm co-founded by former Mississippi Governor Haley Barber. Similarly, in 2014, former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, Republican, Mississippi, and former Senator John Breaux, Democrat, Louisiana, became the main lobbyists for Gazprombank, a subsidiary of Russia's largest supplier of natural gas. More recently, in 2016, millions of dollars in Russian money was funneled to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other high-profile Republicans to finance GOP senatorial candidates. Foreign nationals are prohibited from contributing to Senate races, but according to the Dallas Morning News, during the 2015 to 2016 election season, Ukrainian-born oligarch Leonard Len Blavatnik, who has British-American dual citizenship, put a small fraction of his $20 billion fortune into GOP Senate races. McConnell, who took $2.5 million for his GOP Senate leadership fund from two of Blavatnik's companies, was the leading recipient. Others included political action committees for Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Lindsey Graham, Ohio Governor John Kasich, and Arizona Senator John McCain. When it came to getting legal representation, Russians went to the most connected lawyers in the land. The fourth largest law firm in the United States, Jones Day, itself represented at least 10 major corporations and organizations that were close to Putin's heart, a group comprising both Russia's most powerful corporations and several of the oligarchs who came to Trump's rescue. Jones Day's Russian clients included Oleg Deripaska's Basic Element, the Alpha Group and Access Renova Group, which jointly own billions of dollars in oil and gas assets, Alpha Bank, the largest private commercial bank in Russia and part of the Alpha Group, Letteronia, a $30 billion holding company for assets in technology, oil, and gas, Rosneft, the world's largest listed oil company, the Sapir Organization, which helped fund Bayrock's Trump Soho, the Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation, run by Alexander Mashkevich, the Russian Standard Group, whose holdings included the Miss Russia pageant, Sukhoi Civil Aircraft, a large military aircraft manufacturer in which Mogilevich had an interest, the Alpha Access Renova Group, a joint venture that helped make Leonard Blavatnik one of the wealthiest people in the world, and Victor Vexelberg's Renova Group. Another Jones Day client, the National Rifle Association, according to McClatchy, has been the subject of a multi-agency investigation into whether the Kremlin secretly helped fund efforts to boost Trump by funneling money through the NRA. In July 2018, Maria Butina, an alleged Russian agent in the U.S., was indicted by Special Counsel Robert Mueller on charges of being a covert agent who had infiltrated the NRA and other conservative groups, including the organizers of the National Prayer Breakfast. Butina, who pleaded not guilty, allegedly reported to Alexander Torshin, the deputy head of the Russian Central Bank, who had ties to Russian intelligence services. This, in effect, was the Putin lobby, putting its money into K Street and powerful white shoe law firms to help legitimize and promote the agendas of Russian oligarchs whose billions effectively represented the theft of Russia's patrimony. And when it came to fighting the growing power and reach of the Russian offensive, exactly how was America's national security apparatus handling this mounting threat? As John Cipher told me, the CIA had issued operational directives to stay away from the Russian mob. These issues were not in their purview. As for the FBI, under Director Robert Mueller, it had made Semyon Mogilevich the target of a special new task force in Budapest in 2005, at a time when Mogilevich largely based his operations there. As soon as the task force began investigating his activities, Mogilevich realized he could no longer use Budapest as his base of operations, Mueller said in a 2005 speech. He immediately fled the country and is now hiding in Moscow. Working closely with Hungarian authorities, United States prosecutors obtained a 45-count indictment against Mogilevich and three other criminals, charging them with money laundering, securities fraud, and racketeering. But in the end, Mogilevich eluded their grasp and settled in Moscow. The FBI closed down the Budapest outpost from which it had tracked Mogilevich. Meanwhile, the foreboding assortment of murderous gangsters and tattooed thugs known as the Russian Mafia had climbed the ladder of white-collar respectability, insinuated itself in multi-billion-dollar global corporations, and taken on the protective coloring provided by K Street lobbyists and white shoe law firms. They were now hardwired into some of the most powerful Republican politicians in the country. Like a slow-motion train wreck that can't be stopped, a national security catastrophe of historic proportions was in the works. And it was happening under the noses of the top figures in American law enforcement, whom the Russians were going to for criminal representation. It wasn't enough that William S. Sessions had taken on Mogilevich, the most feared mobster in the world, as a client. Sessions' successor as FBI director, Louis Free, was also working for the Russians. In Free's case, the client in question was Denis Kotsev's Cyprus-based Prevazon Holdings, a giant real estate firm that hired Free to negotiate a settlement with the U.S. government over an alleged money laundering tax fraud scheme involving Kremlin officials. Kotsev is a Ukrainian businessman whose company appeared to be a beneficiary of the $230 million tax fraud. Prevazon won international attention in 2008 when its ties to the massive tax scam were uncovered by Russian tax lawyer Sergei Magnitsky, an anti-corruption specialist who investigated the case on behalf of Hermitage Capital Management, an investment firm co-founded by Bill Browder. After he began investigating the case, Magnitsky was arrested and imprisoned for 11 months without trial. According to the official death certificate, Magnitsky died in prison of closed cerebral cranial injury. Instead of pursuing the real criminals, Russian authorities had gone after Magnitsky. According to his prison diary, investigators kept trying to persuade him to testify against Hermitage and drop his charges against the police and tax authorities. When Magnitsky refused, he was moved to worse and worse sections of the prison. During his imprisonment, he developed several serious medical conditions but was denied appropriate care, was physically assaulted, and died at the Matroskaya Tishina prison in 2009 at the age of 37. Back in 1997, as FBI director, Louis Free had warned that Russian organized crime posed a threat to the U.S. that far transcended mere criminality, and that there was now a greater danger of nuclear attack by such criminal enterprises than there was by the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. But now he represented Prevezon, which had hired him to settle its dispute with the U.S. government. Later, Free bought a $9.38 million mansion in Palm Beach, Florida, just a 10-minute drive from Mar-a-Lago. Meanwhile, relations between Russia and Western officials were approaching a Cold War-level chill. Putin's bête noire was the 2016 Democratic presidential candidate, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. In fact, Clinton had made her feelings about Putin clear in 2008, when, as a senator, she had joked about George W. Bush's famous assessment of Putin. "I looked the man in the eye," the former president had said. "I was able to get a sense of his soul, a man deeply committed to his country and the best interests of his country." Hillary, of course, saw things quite differently. "Because Putin was a KGB agent," she said, "by definition, he doesn't have a soul." 3 years later, in 2011, when mass protests against Putin accused him of having rigged recent elections, Putin blamed then-Secretary of State Clinton for giving aid and comfort to the demonstrators with statements of support. Even though she had gone along with and implemented Obama's reset policy to improve Russian-American relations, Putin knew that Clinton had a much tougher line toward Moscow than others in Obama's cabinet. And when Hillary joined the protesters and said the elections were dishonest and unfair, Putin saw her assessment as a deliberate attempt to undermine his power. "We need to safeguard ourselves from this interference in our internal affairs," Putin said. Ultimately, he feared, she was such a strong supporter of regime change policies that if elected in 2016, she might pose a serious threat to his survival. "Putin was very upset with Clinton and continued to be for the rest of the time that I was in government," Michael McFaul, who served as the U.S. ambassador to Moscow until 2014, told Politico. "One could speculate that this is his moment for payback." If Putin's hired guns went after Hillary, it would not be the first time. Starting in 2011, Paul Manafort, operating on behalf of Ukrainian President Yanukovych, placed articles critical of Hillary Clinton in the Wall Street Journal and on various websites, according to The Guardian, as part of a black ops operation against her. But Putin's calculus involved far more than Ukraine and Hillary Clinton. And when he intervened in the Middle East on behalf of Syria, it was because he had stumbled upon a diabolical and grandiose plan that would drive a dagger deep into the heart of the Western alliance. It began in September 2015, when Putin announced that he would join Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the fight against ISIS. In addition to striking at ISIS, however, Russian air attacks hit countless civilians, so many that in 2016, Amnesty International accused the Russians of joining Assad forces in deliberately targeting hospitals. Before long, Russia, intentionally or not, was creating a massive flow of refugees into Europe. "Russia is extensively involved in the Syrian conflict, but has done virtually nothing to help the 11 million people who have lost their homes and livelihoods as a result," said Bill Frelich, refugee rights program director at Human Rights Watch. According to Senate testimony in 2016 by General Philip Breedlove, the supreme allied commander of NATO, Russia's inaction, far from being an oversight, was part of a deliberate and cunning policy to use the influx of millions of refugees as a political weapon that would destabilize Western Europe. "Together, Russia and the Assad regime are deliberately weaponizing migration in an attempt to overwhelm European structures and break European resolve," Breedlove said. In other words, now that Russia had, inadvertently perhaps, helped spark an immigration crisis that overwhelmed the entire continent, it began a stealth campaign that aided right-wing, anti-immigrant, populist movements and politicians in Great Britain, Germany, the Netherlands, France, Italy, Austria, and more. The more Russia inflamed the crisis in Syria, it found, the more refugees it created, and the more Russia was able to weaken the European Union. The migration emergency served as the perfect catalyst for further action. As Great Britain prepared to vote on whether or not to exit the European Union, aka Brexit, for instance, Russia jumped into the fray. Nigel Farage, leader of the far-right UK Independence Party, fanned anti-EU sentiment while criticizing sanctions against Russia and issuing complimentary appraisals of President Putin. Hundreds of millions of dollars from dubious Russian sources were laundered in British banks. Then, as the vote for Brexit approached in June of 2016, Russian cyber warfare began. According to research conducted jointly by experts from the University of California at Berkeley and Swansea University in Wales, no fewer than 150,000 Twitter accounts linked to Russia began to tweet inflammatory and divisive messages about Brexit, Muslims, and immigrants. Quietly, almost unseen, Putin also attacked NATO's eastern flank through Poland. And again, Mogilevich played a key role in an operation that, according to Polish investigative reporter Tomasz Piatek, succeeded in compromising NATO. The author of the best-selling Macierewicz and His Secrets, Piatek describes a series of convoluted scams starting in the late 80s with David Begotten, the same David Begotten who laundered money through Trump Tower in 1984 and pioneered the Red Daisy gas tax scam, who moved to Poland and, according to Piatek, robbed a lot of Poles through his creation of the infamous First Commercial Bank in Lublin, one of the first commercial banks in post-communist Poland. According to Piatek, operatives tied to Mogilevich and the Solsivskaya crime gang were principals in a 2014 wiretapping scandal where top Polish politicians were secretly recorded at their favorite restaurants, all of which helped the pro-Russia Law and Justice Party to win the elections. The scandal was similar to the wiretapping scandal that led to the fall of Hungarian Prime Minister Ferenc Gyurcsány's government and helped Viktor Orbán, Putin's Hungarian ally, win subsequent elections, Piatek said. The upshot was that in November 2015, when the Law and Justice Party won an absolute majority in Poland for the first time, it appointed Antoni Macierewicz as Minister of Defense. At one time or another in his career, Piatek reported, Macierewicz had given access to classified documents to a company controlled by the Russian mafia in Poland. Among other failings, he had given a radio interview about Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the fraudulent pamphlet that purports to be a Jewish plan for world domination, about which he said, "Experience shows that there are such groups in Jewish circles." Once he became Minister of Defense, Piatek says, Macierewicz began recruiting pro-Kremlin neo-Nazi youngsters as soldiers to fight in his new territorial defense force, which reported directly to him, that is, not to the general command of the Polish army, with which it was in direct competition, and began transferring officers and resources from the army to the TDF. As a result, Piatek says, Macierewicz has been accused of destroying the Polish army and its relationship with its Western allies. And so it went, not just in the UK, Poland, or Hungary, but all over Europe. As a 2018 minority staff report by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee put it, since 2004, Putin had launched a relentless asymmetric assault on democracy in Russia, Europe, and the United States, using an arsenal that includes military invasions, cyber attacks, disinformation, support for fringe political groups, and the weaponization of energy resources, organized crime, and corruption. The Kremlin has refined the use of these tools over time, and these attacks have intensified in scale and complexity across Europe. In Eastern Europe, Russia attacked Ukraine, Georgia, Montenegro, Serbia, Bulgaria, and Hungary. In the Baltic, it attacked Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. In Scandinavia, it went after Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden. And it went after the Netherlands, France, Germany, Spain, and Italy as well. Ultimately, Putin's goal, the Senate report said, was to attack the democracies of Europe and the United States and undermine the transatlantic alliance upon which Europe's peace and prosperity have depended for over 70 years. Needless to say, the Russian mafia was not the only weapon in Putin's arsenal of active measures, a Russian term for political and economic warfare by its security services. Both domestically and with foreign adversaries, Russia hacked its foes, as it did when it captured emails from Hillary Clinton and her allies, so it could release them and damage her presidential campaign. Both domestically and abroad, Putin asserted ironclad control over the Russian narrative through disinformation and propaganda. Only a strong leader like Putin could remind a wronged and humiliated Russia of past glories and rebuild his country into a great superpower again. Only Putin could have annexed Crimea and pushed back against the West. As for the opposition, by this time, dozens of journalists and dissidents had been killed, including Boris Nemtsov, the former deputy prime minister under Yeltsin, who was one of Putin's most prominent critics until February 2015, when he was shot from behind near Moscow's Red Square. To that same end, Putin also had the power to destroy media oligarchs who did not serve his agenda, as Vladimir Kuczynski and Boris Berezovsky found out when they were forced into exile. Outside Russia, where Putin didn't control the media, the Russians resorted to more sophisticated tactics. They hijacked social media and exploited algorithms to make highly provocative fake news go viral. They harnessed the power of social media to amplify the rabid fanaticism of the so-called alt-right, in the process turning Facebook into one of the most powerful publishers of phony news stories and propaganda from Russia and the alt-right in the world. They used third parties, such as Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, to make it seem as if leaks had emanated from heroic whistleblowers rather than being obtained by Russian intelligence. And they deliberately used not only alternative facts and fake news, but bogus websites that pretended to correct fake news, and in the process upended the very notion of truth, of reality itself, of what is real. In all, according to the German Marshall Fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy, the Russian government has used cyber attacks, disinformation, and financial influence campaigns to meddle in the internal affairs of at least 27 European and North American countries since 2004. Within that context, the Russian mafia played the central role in nurturing an exceptionally pliant asset, who initially seemed to be more of a person of influence than a man with real political clout. It had been nearly 30 years since Trump welcomed David Begotten to Trump Tower and facilitated the sale of 5 apartments to help launder Russian mafia money for the first time. Since then, he had accepted many millions of dollars, perhaps billions, for his condos. Vyacheslav Ivankov had lived at Trump Tower and run operations for Mogilevich. Bayrock had been there from 2002 to 2008 and helped Trump rise out of the ashes of Atlantic City and become a billionaire yet again, potentially leaving him deeply, deeply indebted to the Russian mafia. And yet, at 11.05 a.m. on June 16, 2015, Donald Trump stepped on the descending escalator in the pink-marbled, 6-story atrium at Trump Tower and began a journey into history by announcing his candidacy for the Republican nomination for the presidency of the United States. Trump's decision to run had been in the works for some time. In January, Emin Agalarov and Rob Goldstone, Emin's publicist, had visited Trump in Trump Tower. Having seen Emin perform at the Miss Universe pageant, and having appeared in one of Amin's music videos, Trump had told him, "Maybe next time you'll be performing at the White House?" At about the same time, Trump had hired Corey Lewandowski as his campaign manager. In March, he had formed a presidential exploratory committee. And now, 3 months later, Trump was proclaiming that we had become a nation of losers, and that America needed someone really rich, namely him, to restore its lost economic primacy. Starting off by saying he would build a great, great wall to stop illegal immigration and have Mexico foot the bill, he added, "Nobody builds walls better than me, believe me, and I build them very inexpensively," he said. "I don't need anybody's money. It's nice," he said. "I'm not using donors. I don't care. I'm really rich. I'm proud of my net worth. I've done an amazing job." At the time, Trump was still treated largely as a novelty. "Clown runs for prez," read the cover headline of the New York Daily News. A 4% showing in a Washington Post ABC News poll put him in a tie for 9th place among Republican candidates. Worse, the same poll showed him to have a 16% favorable and 71% unfavorable rating. It was later revealed by The Hollywood Reporter that Trump even had to resort to paying $50 each to background actors, like extras in movies, to pretend they were Trump supporters cheering him on at the Trump Tower atrium. To the most seasoned political observers, Trump was an incredible long shot, and they didn't have a clue about his ties to the Russian mob. On the other hand, Putin now had a candidate of his own choosing representing one of America's two major political parties, as the 2016 elections were about to get underway. By this time, Mogilevich had done his job. He had targeted, ensnared, and compromised a powerful and influential American businessman. But now that Trump had real political prospects, Putin went ahead full bore and pulled out other weapons in his arsenal. The Kremlin's active measures were about to go fully operational. The battle had been joined. Chapter 19. Back Channels. Just 2 days after announcing his candidacy, on June 18, 2015, Trump appeared on the Sean Hannity Show on Fox News, where he was asked if he had had any contact with Vladimir Putin and how he might deal with him if he were elected. "Yes," Trump said. "So I was there 2 years ago. We had a tremendous success with the Miss Universe contest, and I own Miss Universe, Miss USA, all of that, and it does great. It's on NBC, but that's okay. But it does fantastically well. And 2 years ago, we had it in Moscow, and it was a tremendous success. And I got to meet everybody. I got to meet all..." "Did you talk to him?" Hannity asked. "I don't want to say, but I got to meet all of the leaders. I got to meet all, I mean... Everybody was there. It was a massive event. And let me tell you, it was tremendous." For an opening, it was a bit tentative and coy, especially for the bombastic Trump. Nevertheless, he had just uttered his first words as a candidate about Putin. "We can get along," Trump said. It was official. The Trump-Putin connection had gone public. A few weeks later, in July, at Freedom Fest, a self-styled festival of free minds in Las Vegas, Trump announced he would probably reverse President Obama's policies and roll back sanctions against Russia. "I know Putin, and I'll tell you what, we get along with Putin," Trump said. "I don't think you'd need the sanctions. I think we would get along very, very well." As it happened, Trump's statement was an answer to a question posed by Maria Butina, a Russian operative who was a protege of Putin ally Alexander Torshin. No sanctions? It was everything Putin and the oligarchs wanted. As if in response, Putin offered Trump praise in return. "He says that he wants to move to another, closer level of relations," Putin told reporters. "Can we really not welcome that? Of course we welcome that." He added that Trump was a colorful and talented person, a compliment Trump said afterward he regarded as an honor. Meanwhile, the Russian cyber warfare campaign against the United States was already underway. According to a January 2017 report by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI, assessing Russian activities and intentions in recent U.S. elections, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the National Security Agency concluded with high confidence that Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the U.S. presidential election. Russia's goals were to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. To gather ammunition for that influence campaign, on an undetermined date in July 2015, a bit more than 43 years after five burglars broke into the Democratic National Committee offices at the Watergate Hotel in Washington, the DNC offices were broken into again, not by burglars, but by Russian hackers. The Democrats first found out about it in the most indirect way imaginable. In September, an agent from the FBI's Washington field office left a phone message at the DNC office for an outsourced low-level computer technician who did not bother to return the call. They left a phone message at the help desk of the DNC, John Podesta, then Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, told CNN. They didn't treat it with the kind of seriousness I think that it deserved. According to the DNC, the FBI repeatedly called its help desk but never reached out to DNC leaders. As a result, according to a complaint filed by the Democratic National Committee against the Russian Federation and the Trump campaign, Russian intelligence gained access to Democratic National Committee DNC networks and maintained that access until at least June 2016. Consequently, the complaint said, the GRU, Russian military intelligence, was able to exfiltrate large volumes of data from the DNC and leading Democratic officials. The ODNI report also noted that Putin publicly said it was important the DNC data was exposed to WikiLeaks. We assess with high confidence that the GRU relayed material it acquired from the DNC and senior Democratic officials to WikiLeaks, the report said. Moscow most likely chose WikiLeaks because of its self-proclaimed reputation for authenticity. Meanwhile, Trump's candidacy took off like a rocket. In a jam-packed field of 17 Republican candidates jostling for the nomination, Trump, ever the master showman, surged to the fore, a bombastic New York tycoon pandering to tens of millions of forgotten Americans, promising to make America great again. Having put together a base in part by falsely claiming that President Obama had been born in Kenya and therefore was not eligible to be president, Trump derided Jeb Bush as low energy, Senator Ted Cruz as Lion Ted, Senator Marco Rubio as Little Marco, and Hillary Clinton, always, of course, as Crooked Hillary. By mid-July, just a few weeks after he announced his candidacy, Trump had claimed first place in two major polls. He called Mexicans rapists. He mocked war hero John McCain for getting captured. One after another, Trump trampled the widely accepted norms of American political discourse, and not only got away with it, but awakened and inflamed the passions of a right-wing anti-immigrant fervor that had been the sleeping giant in American politics. He was so often compared to P.T. Barnum that a Nexus search in May 2018 found more than 1,500 articles in which Trump was mentioned with Barnum. He represented something larger than life, even if that reputation never held up to scrutiny. Opponents who underestimated the loyalty of his base did so at their peril. The more he broke the rules, the more they loved it. I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? Trump told supporters in Iowa about a week before the state's caucuses. It's like incredible. The mere fact that Trump was running for president did not mean he had abandoned his dreams of building a Trump Tower in Moscow. Far from it. In fact, the relationship he had cultivated with the Agalarovs was still very much alive. On July 24, 2015, Rob Goldstone, the music promoter who worked with Amin Agalarov, invited Trump to Moscow to celebrate the birthday of Amin's father, Aras Agalarov, the real estate oligarch. In an email to Trump's assistant, Rona Graf, Goldstone proffered an inducement. Maybe he would welcome a meeting with President Putin, Goldstone wrote. Trump didn't take the bait, but Felix Sater was still traveling to Moscow on behalf of the illusory Trump Tower in Russia. By this time, Bayrock was so deeply entangled in litigation that it had folded its tent. Felix Sater had become a senior advisor to Trump and continued to work with his old pal Michael Cohen, trying to draw up deals for Trump. We did not own real estate together, but certainly looked at a bunch of stuff together during Trump and post-Trump, Sater told Talking Points Memo. After I left Bayrock, I was still looking at deals for Trump, but I would think about real estate with Michael. It was just two real estate guys talking. According to emails published by the New York Times, Sater saw the eventual realization of Trump Tower Moscow as a coup for Trump that would enhance his chances as a candidate, not conflict with them. In the emails, Sater boasted to Cohen that he had arranged financing for a Trump Tower in Moscow from VTB, a bank that was under U.S. sanctions for undermining democracy in Ukraine. On November 3, 2015, he also emailed Cohen, "I arranged for Ivanka to sit in Putin's chair at his desk and office in the Kremlin. I will get Putin on this program, and we will get Donald elected. We both know no one else knows how to pull this off without stupidity or greed getting in the way. I know how to play it, and we will get this done. Buddy, our boy can become president of the USA, and we can engineer it. I will get all of Putin's team to buy in on this. I will." In one of his emails, Sater vowed to pull out all the stops and use his connections to get Putin to praise Trump's business expertise. "If he says it, we own this election," Sater wrote. "America's most difficult adversary, agreeing that Donald is a good guy to negotiate." According to someone familiar with the emails, the Washington Post reported, Sater also wrote Cohen something like, "Can you believe two guys from Brooklyn are going to elect a president?" Meanwhile, as the Trump campaign staffed up, Russophile policy wonks flocked to Trump's side and began solidifying their ties to Moscow. On December 15, 2015, Trump campaign foreign policy advisor Lieutenant General Michael Flynn attended a gala dinner in Moscow in honor of RT, the Russian media outlet on which Flynn appeared occasionally as an analyst, and sat next to President Putin, leading Politico to characterize him as one of the most intriguing examples of how the Russians have recruited disaffected members of the U.S. political establishment. Flynn, who had been fired in 2014 as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency by Obama, was paid approximately $45,000 by the Russians for giving a speech at a related event. In early January 2016, Carter Page, who had helped open the Moscow office of Merrill Lynch, met with Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski at Trump Tower and became an unpaid volunteer for the foreign policy committee Trump was said to be forming. In March, 28-year-old George Papadopoulos was recruited to join the foreign policy team as well, and was told improved relations with Russia would be a cornerstone of Trump's foreign policy. A week later, Papadopoulos flew to Rome and met Joseph Mifsud, a former Maltese diplomat based at the London Academy of Diplomacy. On March 24th, there was a follow-up meeting at which Mifsud was accompanied by a woman Papadopoulos identified wrongly as Putin's niece. Putin does not have a niece. After corresponding with the woman, the professor, and others, Papadopoulos met over breakfast in a London hotel with Mifsud, who told him that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton. They, the Russians, have dirt on her. They have thousands of emails. After this, Papadopoulos continued to communicate with the Trump campaign and his Russian government interlocutors. In an interview with La Repubblica, the Italian news outlet, Mifsud denied Papadopoulos' account and said he never stated that the Russian government had dirt on Hillary Clinton. Trump and Manafort weren't the only influential Americans to have questionable relations with Russians during this period. Manafort had brought with him Rick Gates, Rick Davis, and Tad Devine from his firm in D.C. The lone Democrat in the operation, Devine had worked on both Al Gore's and John Kerry's campaigns, and later became the senior campaign strategist for Senator Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential run. Tad Devine worked for Yanukovych in the 2006 Ukraine parliamentary elections, in which Yanukovych ended up as prime minister, and the 2010 presidential election, which Yanukovych won. Devine did not return a phone call from the author. Russians always had more success with Republicans than Democrats, but it wasn't for want of trying. In 1993, Grigory Luchansky, an alleged former Mogilevich associate, was invited to a Democratic National Committee fundraising dinner for Bill Clinton, during which President Clinton, unaware of Luchansky's resume, asked him to please tell the Ukrainian government that it would be great if it reduced its nuclear stockpile. Afterward, Clinton posed for a photo with Luchansky, which the alleged mobster passed out to enhance his stature. When the photo was eventually published, the CIA did a double take before realizing it was genuine. Luchansky had one thing in mind, legitimization, a congressional investigator probing Russian organized crime explained. He wanted U.S. citizenship, and he wanted to buy a U.S. bank. Luchansky has repeatedly denied any ties to the Russian mafia, but he has been identified by law enforcement authorities as a figure in the Russian crime network. Similarly, in 2012, the European Center for a Modern Ukraine, a Ukrainian nonprofit representing Yanukovych's Party of Regions, employed the Podesta Group, run by Tony Podesta, whose brother, John Podesta, became the campaign chairman for Hillary Clinton. By this point, even though most Americans didn't realize it, Putin and his allies had put money, directly and indirectly, on political consultants who were tied to campaigns for the three strongest candidates for the presidency of the United States in 2016. Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and Hillary Clinton. For all the millions he had made in Ukraine, Manafort had fallen on hard times. Oleg Deripaska's net worth had plummeted after the 2008 financial crisis, which meant he wanted Manafort to liquidate a fund Manafort was overseeing and give Deripaska back his share, some $17 million, according to financial statements obtained by the New York Times. But Manafort had already spent a fortune on real estate, rare antique rugs, and the like. He had blown millions investing in his son-in-law's real estate ventures and his daughter Jessica's film. He was out of cash. Rather than pay Deripaska back, according to the indictment, Manafort simply stopped responding to him. Now, with Trump's assent, Manafort saw a chance to get back in the game. He had known Trump for decades, had worked for him on occasion, and kept a condo in Trump Tower, though he said their relationship was largely confined to small talk. So in mid-February, as recounted by Franklin Foer in The Atlantic, Paul Manafort reached out to real estate magnate Tom Barrack, a longtime friend who was also close to Trump. For decades, Manafort had personified the Washington insider, but now he crafted a memo portraying himself as the polar opposite, saying he was a longtime foe of Karl Rove, who had avoided the political establishment in Washington since 2005. Having charged Ukrainian oligarchs exorbitant fees, Manafort switched his approach when it came to Trump. Any remuneration he might get from the campaign, he seemed to be thinking, was nothing compared to the riches that would come with his newfound influence. As a result, he offered to be Trump's campaign manager absolutely free of charge. Tom Barrack added a cover letter to Trump that described Manafort in terms that were certain to be appealing to the candidate, as the most experienced and lethal of managers, and a killer. In March, Manafort joined the campaign as an advisor, with Corey Lewandowski still in place as campaign manager. Next, Manafort called Konstantin Kilimnik, the aide-de-camp he had relied on so heavily in Ukraine, and who frequently served as Manafort's go-between with Deripaska. Deeply in debt to Deripaska, Manafort nonetheless saw the billionaire as his savior. If he was hired as Trump's campaign manager, Manafort was certain Deripaska would see things in a new light. Perhaps private briefings on the campaign from Trump's campaign manager himself would put him back in favor? Manafort sent a batch of press clippings to Kilimnik, celebrating his new job with Trump. "How do we use these articles to get whole?" Manafort emailed Kilimnik. "Has OVD, Deripaska operation, seen?" Kilimnik replied that he thought that they would get back to the original relationship with Deripaska in time. Kilimnik, meanwhile, was a year into running a political consulting firm called Begemot Ventures International, BVI, with a Washington-based operative named Sam Patton, whose relationship with Kilimnik went back nearly two decades, to when they were colleagues at the International Republican Institute, a GOP-aligned foreign policy group. In 2014, Patton had begun working with a data mining firm called Cambridge Analytica in an effort to introduce new technologies and methodologies to U.S. campaigns during the 2014 congressional cycle. Specializing in psychographic profiling, the company used online data to create sophisticated personality profiles for voters, who could then be targeted with specifically tailored messages that could encourage or discourage them from voting one way or another. Not long after Manafort came on board, one of his daughters texted the other that Manafort and Trump were literally living in the same building, and they go up and down all day long, hanging and plotting together, according to a tweet by New York Times reporter Ken Vogel. As the Republican primaries got underway in early 2016, the beta run of Cambridge Analytica's efforts to micro-target voters for president was adopted by the presidential campaign for Texas Senator Ted Cruz. But when the Cruz campaign fizzled, Cambridge Analytica persuaded Trump's digital director, Brad Parscale, to try out the firm. As Trump won one Republican primary after another in the spring of 2016 and increasingly looked to be the presumed nominee, so the alt-right brain trust gravitated toward his candidacy, including one of the principal owners of Cambridge Analytica, billionaire Robert Mercer, an investor in Breitbart News. In addition, former Breitbart chair Stephen Bannon, a senior advisor to Trump, who was sometimes viewed as the candidate's Svengali, served as vice president of CA's board until the campaign. Cambridge Analytica was created in 2013 as the American arm of a British company called Strategic Communications Laboratories Group, SCL. But like so much of the Trump-Russia scandal, the story of Cambridge Analytica is shrouded in fog, with parts of its ownership hidden in an elaborate web of interlocking tangential relationships that are difficult to decipher. For about 10 years, from 2005 to 2015, SCL's largest shareholder was Vincent Cengiz, who together with his brother Robert is estimated to be worth about $1.1 billion. But according to an article in the online magazine Tablet by Ann Marlowe, an author and visiting fellow at the Hudson Institute, Cengiz happened to be partners with none other than Dmitry Firtash through his investment in a holding company called the Zander Group, the largest shareholder of which, with 28% of the shares, was a Cyprus-based company called Spadi Trading. Spadi was owned by Group DF, as in Dmitry Firtash. It is unclear whether this relationship had implications for the operations of SCL, but there is no question that a Trump presidency would have been in Firtash's interests and those of his partner, Semyon Mogilevich. Meanwhile, Trump's astounding success during the primaries had left political analysts dumbfounded. By mid-March, he had dispatched would-be standard-bearers of the GOP establishment, former Florida governor and presidential brother and son Jeb Bush, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and others, so that for most of the spring, it was a three-man race, with Trump going up against Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Ohio Governor John Kasich. Then on May 3rd, Trump won every delegate in the Indiana primary, which meant that Senator Cruz, his leading adversary, no longer had a road to the Republican nomination. There was so much rancor between the old guard GOP stalwarts and the Trump insurgency that there was talk about mutiny at the July convention. But the bottom line was Trump had become the presumptive nominee, and that meant he had to build a team for the general election so he could focus on Clinton. To that end, on June 20th, Trump fired campaign manager Corey Lewandowski and replaced him with Paul Manafort. Lewandowski had never run a major campaign before, and as Trump prepared for the possible battle on the floor of the RNC, the stated reason for the personnel shift had to do with Manafort's vast experience. In 1976, Manafort had helped manage Gerald Ford's floor fight in his showdown with Ronald Reagan. He and Roger Stone had helped perform a similar service for Reagan in 1980, and had played key roles for George H.W. Bush in 1988 and Bob Dole in 1996. Ultimately, Paul is in charge, Barry Bennett, a senior advisor to the Trump campaign, told the New York Times. He's got the experience to help get Mr. Trump across the finish line. That was the official story, and it was pretty much how the mainstream press presented it. But another way to look at it was that Team Trump had continued to solidify its connections to Team Putin. In addition to having been paid tens of millions by Putin and his allies, Manafort was likely deeply in hock to Deripaska and had already proffered his services to the oligarch for private briefings, creating a back channel to Putin. And of course, Manafort was still working with Konstantin Kilimnik with his GRU ties. Foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos had also met with his mysterious Maltese diplomat, Joseph Mifsud, about getting dirt on Hillary's emails. In addition, there were Trump's ties to the Agalarovs. During the early stages of the primaries, Aras Agalarov had conveyed his support to Trump via an email channel that went from Aras to Rob Goldstone, Amin's publicist, to Donald Jr. On February 29th, Goldstone had sent an email to Donald Jr. saying that, on the eve of Super Tuesday, with 11 states voting in GOP primaries, Amin's father had asked him to pass along Aras's attached letter, along with support from many of his important Russian friends and colleagues. The attached letter offered Trump best wishes in a conventional, anodyne manner. What was more important was that the Agalarov channel was open. It was activated again on June 3rd when Goldstone emailed Don Jr. Amin just called and asked me to contact you with something very interesting. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father Aras this morning and in their meeting offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, helped along by Aras and Amin. What do you think is the best way to handle this information, and would you be able to speak to Amin about it directly? I can also send this info to your father via Rona, but it is ultra-sensitive, so wanted to send to you first. Best, Rob Goldstone. The title, Crown Prosecutor, does not exist in Russia, but in a number of jurisdictions in the British Commonwealth,